The first reading this morning comes from the Gospel of Mark, which was written around 71 of the Common Era by an anonymous author whom we only know by tradition as Mark. After they left Bethany, he felt hungry. He saw a fig tree in the distance with leaves, and he went up to see if he could find any figs on it. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves, for it wasn't the season for figs. And so he spoke to the tree and said to it, "Henceforth, may no one ever eat fruit from you." His students heard what he said. When they reached Jerusalem, he climbed into the temple, and he began to drive out the merchants, and he turned over the tables of the cashiers and the pigeon dealers' seats, and he would not allow anyone to use the courtyard as a shortcut from one part of the city to the other. Then he began to teach, "It's put this way in our scriptures, 'My house is a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have turned it into a refuge for racketeers.'" When evening came, he and his students left the city. Next morning, as they were walking past, they noticed that the fig tree had withered from the root. The second reading is a poem by one of my favorite poets, Naomi Shihab Nye, written in 2002. It's called "My Father and the Fig Tree." The name Joha in the poem is the Palestinian trickster figure. And Naomi Shihab Nye is a Palestinian American.
For other fruits, my father was indifferent. He'd point to the cherry trees and say, "See those? I wish they were figs." In the evening, he sat by my bed, weaving folk tales like vivid little scarves. They always involved a fig tree. Even when it didn't fit, he'd stick it in. Once Joha was walking down the road, and he saw a fig tree. Or he tied his camel to a fig tree and went to sleep. Or later, when they caught him and arrested him, his pockets were full of figs. At age 6, I ate a dried fig and shrugged. "That's not what I'm talking about," he said. "I'm talking about a fig straight from the earth, gift of Allah, on a branch so heavy it touches the ground. I'm talking about picking the largest, fattest, sweetest fig in the world and putting it in my mouth." Here he'd stop and close his eyes. Years passed, and we lived in many houses. None had fig trees. We had lima beans, zucchini, parsley, beets. "Plant one," my mother said, but my father never did. He tended garden half-heartedly, forgot to water, let the okra get too big. What a dreamer he is. Look how many things he starts and doesn't finish. The last time he moved, I got a phone call, my father in Arabic chanting a song I've never heard. "What's that?" He took me out back to the new yard. There in the middle of Dallas, Texas, a tree with the largest, fattest, sweetest figs in the whole world. "It's a fig tree song," he said, plucking his fruits like ripe tokens, emblems assured of the world that was always his own.
Thank you.
Not long before he died, my father was sitting in his wheelchair at the dining room table. It was, in fact, the last time he sat at table. From that day on, he couldn't get out of bed, no matter how much help he had. My mother was also sitting at the table that day, and I was there, and my sister was there. The supper was simple that night, the conversation somewhat minimal for an Italian-American family. Without warning, my father suddenly sat bolt upright in his chair, and he hunched his shoulders, and then he raised his hands, and he waved them as if he was conducting a band. And then he burst out singing, "Up we go into the wild blue yonder, climbing high into the sun." We all looked at him with complete bafflement. And it even took us a few seconds to realize that this was a song that we all recognized. But then I recognized that he couldn't remember any more than the first two lines. And so, being the iPhone fanatic that I am, I took my phone, dialed in a few numbers, and found online the rest of the lyrics for the song, and enlarged the letters as much as I could and held it up to him, and he finished singing the first verse of the song, conducting the whole time. Now, I suppose my father knew this song because he had served in the Army Air Force during the 1940s war. However, sometime while he was in the Army Air Force, he contracted, of all things, yellow fever, a terrible illness, very rare here in the States, that ended his flight training for good. But I assure you, in all of the years that we lived with him, none of us had ever heard him sing that song or reference it at all at any other time. He had talked a few days earlier about his yellow fever during the war and his weeks of recovery done by the Salton Sea in Southern California, and we figured that's what prompted his memory of the song. But then, after letting the surprising incident sink in for a few hours, I realized that I was being a tad literal in my interpretation of things, thinking it was only a concrete memory come to life. I realized that his sudden song, well, based on memory, was probably his way of reconciling himself to his own coming end. After all, for the last month, he had been saying things like this almost every day. "One day, not long from now, I'm going to be way up there with my ma and my pa playing pinochle. Up there, the wild blue yonder." Seeing past the literal meaning made the event far more poignant for me and strangely touching. Taking things literally can just be a way of stopping too soon. For example, if I take literally the story of King David in the Bible and then read that archaeologists have so far not been able to find much evidence for a vast empire ruled by a guy named David 3,000 years ago, then I lose the story because it's not a literal play-by-play reporting. If I think a story has to be literally true in order to be true at all, it's my expectation which robs me of the power of the story. Like in the wonderful children's story this morning, if I expect a blanket and only a blanket and never a little button and certainly never a little story about the blanket and the button, I'm not going to be very happy. But if I allow myself to be more flexible and realistic in my expectations and take the story of King David for what it is, a poignant story about love and loss, courage and cowardice, hate and rage, beauty, sexist power, entitlement, disappointment and lust, self-doubt, mystical rapture, and justice, well, then I can be moved. I can be inspired. Or better, I can come to transformative new understandings about my own loves and my own losses, my own self-doubts, and my own raptures. After all, as I say each and every year at the Passover Seder, a story is true in the way that a story is true. On the other side of the equation, if I read the story from the Gospel of Mark about the fig tree and then get all upset because the teacher showed pique against the fig tree and cursed it, I am also allowing a rigid literalism to siphon off the power of this slice of ancient literature. Unfortunately, to read the ancient scriptures literally, that means uncritically, is what we have all been trained to do. And I mean all of us. Doesn't make any difference if we grew up in a conservative church or a conservative synagogue. Somehow, it's become universal, and I have no idea how to explain that. But it is universal. And by reading scripture uncritically, I mean reading it without taking the time, to look at language, context, history, and literary styles. To open up and read the Bible is just a waste of time, unless you do all of that. People as brilliant as Bertrand Russell, brilliant man, certainly critiqued the scriptures very well, but he did so from an entirely literal perspective. And thus, his famous essay, Why I Am Not a Christian, leaves me completely cold, even though, like him, I don't call myself a Christian. The fig tree in Mark's story can make no sense in truth unless you refuse a literal reading with all of your might. It's absolutely necessary to reference other literary references to make that story make sense, like the book of Jeremiah. Mark's Jesus gives us a clue, asks us to connect with Jeremiah when he actually quotes the prophet during the temple incident. My house is a house of prayer for all the nations. Not only did the Hebrew prophet Jeremiah write that sentence, he also predicted in his book the destruction of the temple in his own day, announcing that it was going to collapse into a heap of ruin just like the old temple at Shiloh did. But beyond that, he also offered us a reason why temples fall at all, or why they should fall. When I wanted to gather them, says the Eternal, there were no figs on the fig tree. Even the leaves were withered, for the heritage I left them had passed away from them. The heritage I left them had passed away from them. The Torah. So then, when you look at the historical context on top of the literary context, you find out that the temple in both Jeremiah's time and in Jesus' day was not just a religious center. There was no separation of temple and state in those days. It was the center of the ruling aristocracy as well. It was the IRS. It was the chief employer in the city, almost a monopoly, in fact. And you get a sense of Mark's understanding of what Jesus did in the temple by overturning the cashier tables and pigeon seller seats when you look at that history. Please, it was not a matter of a clearly practicing Jew like Jesus criticizing Jewish religious practice. When people say that, it drives me crazy. Or worse, he wasn't foolishly saying that spirituality is somehow tainted by financial reality. Another little anti-Semitic statement that comes up when people read this story. No, he was making a political, social, economic statement about an aristocratic system which collaborated with Roman oppression so as to gain privileges, denied the poor and the sick, including affordable medical care and gainful employment. One reason, in fact, that Jesus got himself into trouble even before he staged his little act of street theater in the temple was that he himself offered acts of healing, to use the modern word, health care, for free to the poor who couldn't afford regular and ruinously expensive medical care. So the story, as Mark tells it, is this. If the purpose of the temple, the official shelter for the aristocracy in cahoots with Rome, is now to ignore the commands of the Torah, this blessed heritage, do not defraud, do not defer to the powerful, you shall not deceive each other, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Well then, why not tear the damn thing down? What good is it? If the fig tree, symbol of the temple, bears no fruit, let it perish. For the people are indeed hungry, hungry for justice, the sweetest, fattest fruit of all. They do not need a tree that produces nothing. You see how much more poignant things get when you take the time to avoid the literal reading of things and go deeper? But you know, I don't want you to get me wrong here. That doesn't mean I have no appreciation for the literal side of things. I'm not saying that being literal is somehow always wrong. Not at all. It's a terrible way to approach literature, I think, biblical or otherwise. But frankly, I like a literal fig, not a metaphorical fig. As some of you know, I grew up with them in my backyard up in Detroit, where every fall we would bury the whole tree to preserve it through the winter so it would spring up again in the spring and we could have figs by August. They are my favorite fruit, the fig, along with, I suppose, tangerines and oranges. Like Naomi Shihab Nye's Palestinian father, I want the biggest, fattest figs, fresh from the tree and not all dried up in a Newton. I want to feast on the red, seedy flesh, the dark purple skin, so earthy in taste. I don't want a symbolic fig out of the book of Jeremiah. I want a real fig from a tree in my backyard. Now, I don't live in Dallas like the poet's father does, Dallas where it's nice and warm and figs can grow pretty easy. I live in Columbus where snowfall can bury the crocuses. But this last summer, I bought a fig tree anyway, a new kind of fig tree that has been bred, unlike Palestinian fig trees or my grandfather's fig trees, to be deciduous, to drop its leaves automatically in the fall and then to spring back up in the spring, unfurling the leaves. There is my little fig tree right up there on top. The leaves are coming out and it's beautiful. It's so small you can barely see it, but I assure you it's the most beautiful tree in the world, and if you don't believe me, you can come up afterward and worship it. It may take years before I grow a crop of figs, but I'm willing to cultivate the thing until then. Oh, what a dreamer he is, say Nye's relatives, critical of her father. Look at how many things he starts and doesn't finish. Now, for me, being called a dreamer is not an insult. I'm a dreamer, too, and I'm not ashamed of it. And just like I want literal figs, not symbolic figs, to hold in my hand, to drop in my hungry mouth, I want literal justice that I can touch and that I can taste, not some mirage of shimmering utopian hope. The health bill just passed recently. The health bill just passed. And you know that there's a lot of folks out there now mustering strong attacks against it. But nevertheless, I dream of, I want literal, non-metaphoric health care for everyone in the country. I can't produce a list of folks that shouldn't get health care. Can you? Can anyone here give me a list of the names of all the citizens or maybe even the visitors to our country who should die on the streets unattended and ignored just because they are who they are? I also dream of civility. I want literal civility. I don't want to hear sarcastic and, I personally believe, racialized metaphors like Obamacare instead of the simple word healthcare. It's not Obamacare, it's healthcare. I don't want history's new Kristallnacht, symbolic stones crashing through a congressperson's windows. I don't want to hear symbolic words like Minority Leader John Boehner's Armageddon, which is a biblical word that refers literally to a ruined fort in the Galilee, but metaphorically refers to a catastrophic battle at the end of the world. It is not the end of time. I want health care literally and carefully now, shepherded by people who love their brothers and sisters and consider it an injustice if they die for lack of treatment. And I want it now, not at the end of time, not at the end of the world. I dream of justice for immigrants. When the U.S. State Department gives DNA tests to Somali refugee families who immigrate to Columbus from that awful Somali refugee camp in Kenya with 350,000 inhabitants, size of the city of Oakland, California, to determine if all their children are genetically related to the parents, sending the adoptees back to the camp, tearing them from their adopted families. I want them to stop it, to literally stop it, not to metaphorically stop it. I want literal justice for immigrants in this country, not legislated heartlessness. I want literal justice like Jesus and Nye's father wanted literal figs from their literal trees. A fig tree that produces figs satisfies deep hunger. A fig tree that does not produce figs has no purpose. Just as any policy that obstructs justice, that is, equal access to privilege and power for one and all, has forgotten its purpose. And Jeremiah reminded us of that a mere 2,700 years ago. Whether it's the policy of the United States government, don't ask, don't tell, or a policy of the state of Ohio, you'll marry who we tell you to marry and no one else, I want a literal end to such policies. I don't want a symbolic end. I think street theater might be fun, a few overturned tables and all that, but that's not enough. I dare to dream of a literal end to the policies that ridicule, obliterate, or distort justice. I want the policies of injustice to literally wither, just like that metaphorical fig tree withered. And to the root. I want them to dry up and blow away, and then I want a new tree to rise up, unfurl its green and beautiful leaves, and bear sweet, fat, delicious figs, plenteous and delicious. So by all means, literalism does have a place. Yes, it's not the best way to read literature. But I'm also sure that any policies of justice that do not promote literal justice, real, solid, and factual justice, amount to anything. The poet's father, she tells us, sang her a little fig song in Arabic when he gazed upon his beautiful backyard fig tree. My father sang me a song too as he faced his own coming death. These songs were symbolic. They were powerful vehicles for expressing and carrying deep, deep human emotion. They were not to be taken literally, but they were meant to be taken seriously. But no matter what music we make or songs we sing, justice, I say to you, is either literal, or it doesn't exist at all.